Hi, Charisse here with a special announcement. You can now enjoy select episodes of Detailed in video form. That's right. Detailed is now available on RCAT's YouTube channel. Now, you may be thinking, I already listened to the podcast. No need to watch it on YouTube. Well, trust me, if you don't want to miss out, even if you're an avid listener of the podcast, the video format is a completely different experience. Not only is it like hanging out with us, but you also get to hear parts of the conversation that were left on the cutting room floor. You can also see the photos, drawings, and video as we discuss the incredible projects that are featured. Come join us on YouTube. Follow the link in our show notes, and let's get into the details. This is an original podcast by RCAT. Try the number one most used website for finding building product information and save time and money. No registration is required with RCAT, so try it today and get ahead on your next project. Visit RCAT.com. That's ARCAT.com.
When we are able to find something that we really believe in and that you know we're committed to in design and find a way or discover a way that it's linked to something that you just can't argue with, you know, code or, you know, durability or budget, and kind of do the judo move and turn that on its head so that it becomes this win-win. I think that's the magic of architecture.
Right. And that's the way to defend the design is right. To write it into the DNA.
Yeah.
You can't pull it apart anymore.
This is Detailed, an original podcast by RCAT. I am your host, Charisse Lakeside, senior specification writer at RDH Building Science and fondly known as the CSI Kraken. We will speak with professionals who share their insights into the most complex, interesting, and odd building conditions and the ingenuity it took to make it work. Join me as I pull back the curtain on the building industry and uncover the lessons learned. You'll gain valuable knowledge to help you better navigate your next project. My guests today are Christopher Roach, principal, and Jacqueline Fung, studio director at Studio Vera in San Francisco, California. Christopher is a San Francisco-based architect and urbanist with over 25 years of professional experience and a deep commitment to both the craft and the intellectual ambition of architecture. Before co-founding Studio Vera, Christopher worked at several notable offices in San Francisco, Austin, and Germany, and has engaged with a wide range of project types from custom residences and affordable housing to commercial offices and academic institutions. Over her 20-plus years of experience, Jackie has jumped from custom residential and high-end retail to transportation, healthcare, education, urban planning, commercial interiors, housing, and back again. The advantage of accumulating these varied perspectives has given her the confidence to meet challenges of varying complexity. At Studio Vera, Jackie has continued to build on her wide range of experience by tackling new projects of all shapes and sizes, while always staying focused on the design problem in its purest form and its respective solution. The project we will be chatting about today is the Redwood Highway offices in Mill Valley, California. But before we get started, don't forget to take a look at the project photos and drawings as you listen along. You can click the link in our show notes or visit www.rcat.com/podcast. The Redwood Highway offices underwent a remarkable transformation, turning a mundane commercial structure into a light-filled haven tailored for a high-end residential builder with an exclusive clientele. The project had four main goals: capture the client's mysterious brand, embrace an industrial look, strategically incorporate natural daylight, and execute the project efficiently with careful material use.
You know, it's interesting that within the framework of our practice, this was kind of one of our first you know, what I call stretch projects. Our practice started really as, you know, residential focused. I had done more commercial and multifamily, and Jackie had done, you know, lots of commercial and new cities in China and airports and things like that. But as Studio Vara, we were really, you know, working on custom homes. And there was an individual who was the owner's representative for a large home that we did. And we, you know, developed a great relationship with him and built a lot of trust with him. And he worked for, at the time, the top-notch, high-end residential home builder, general contractor in the Bay Area called Van Acker Construction. And they were, at the time, you know, growing and looking for space. And they found this building. And he tapped us to help them at the beginning just do a refresh of the interior of the building. So the building itself is a, what we call a big dumb box. It was a, you know, stucco box with a fake classical pediment entry and a funky partial mansard roof on it that was originally an Ethan Allen showroom. Anybody remembers Ethan Allen furniture?
Yeah, I'm about to cycle back there.
And it's on Redwood Highway, which is the main kind of highway artery that leads, you know, from Southern California to Northern California, passes through San Francisco and up through Marin County and Mill Valley. So it is located in this kind of very small strip of commercial buildings, kind of on the frontage road of Redwood Highway. And it's the last building in that row. And the contractor, you know, Van Acker, was looking for a place where that was big enough for their in-office staff. It had a lot of storage because they actually do store, you know, some materials for their projects. And that was a little bit under the radar. This was one of the kind of interesting parts of the design brief, was that they're a firm that has an incredible reputation but doesn't really advertise. You know, it's sort of the, if you know, you know that you should hire them. And Gary Van Acker, who's the founder, really wanted this building to be, as he called it, a stealth building. So he liked that it was easy to find, but kind of, you know, not super prominent. And it's 30,000 square feet, a big square, you know, one floor that's all interior space and one whole basement space that daylights to the parking because of the slope of the site. So it was a perfect fit for them, but, you know, it was a crappy building that was built to last 20, 25 years, right? It was CMU foundation retaining walls. It was 2x framing for the perimeter walls, for the exterior walls. I think like 2x4, not even 2x6. And its only redeeming kind of structural quality was once they ripped down the, you know, T-bar ceilings, they discovered that the roof structure was actually these really beautiful, big, I don't know, like 20-inch deep glue lamps. And then, you know, dimensional lumber purlins in between. And then, you know, a nice kind of sheathing for the roof. And then those glue lamps were supported at, you know, in between points on nice little thin steel columns. And then the floor was joists above the basement. So, as I said, it started as, well, we're just going to, you know, rip out these ceilings and expose this cool roof structure and, you know, maybe add a couple of new skylights, because, you know, there were hardly any windows at all. It was a, you know, dark, you know, artificially lit retail showroom.
also the footprint of the building is, it was huge. It was like 125 square. And this was the kind of furniture showroom, not like today's where you walk into Crate and Barrel and it's like all light filled and everyone's feeling like inspired, you know. It was just like almost 80s-ish where it was like a, you know, a bunch of partitions and dark spaces that were all artificially lit. And every corner you turn, it's like a new, you know, dark bedroom or something. It was gross.
Little kind of artificially lit vignettes.
Yeah. So nasty.
Yeah. So anyway, they were going to rip all of that out and just, you know, make a nice interior space. And we started working on design, and because they're general contractors building this building for themselves, they did not follow the traditional, you know, linear design, bid, build, project delivery. It was going to be a little bit more freestyle, a little bit more design build. And so we started design and they started demo before we even had, you know, even a permit.
Yeah. Because they wanted it yesterday.
Because,
right?
Of course.
Every client wants it done yesterday.
Every client wants it done yesterday, especially, you know, general contractor who is ready to just go, go, go. And as they started doing demo, they did some forensic demo of the exterior of the building and discovered, A, that it was just 2x4 framing. It was, you know, really toothpicks. And there was a ton of dry rot behind all this, you know, stucco. So they kind of, not on purpose, grew the scope into a, well, we're going to rip off the entire envelope of the building and resheathe it. And that opened this whole realm of possibilities for, you know, kind of rethinking the exterior expression of the building, adding windows and skylights, etc.
Repositioning and adaptive reuse have merged as today's IT design strategies. However, these projects are not always cheaper or easy to conform to current codes and regulations. I was curious to get Chris and Jackie's take on why these types of projects are seemingly recurring.
I think it should be said that repositioning and adaptive reuse, they used to just be called renovation.
Yeah. Fancy words for the same thing.
Yeah. But now the fancy words are reflecting, you know, today's trends and needs, right?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. One of the reasons that this has become such a hot topic, and, you know, there's conferences, there's books specifically about repositioning or adaptive reuse, is I think number one, our community realizing that the most sustainable thing that we can do with our built environment is to extend the life of the buildings that we already have. And, you know, we all know and we see it in every project that we start that has demolition. It's painful. It's painful to watch, you know, even if it's a worthless kind of old building, all of this material with all its, you know, embodied carbon and, you know, labor and everything knocked down and dragged off to a landfill.
It is the waste.
It's the waste.
And it doesn't matter your budget or your background.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just pretty obvious.
And that's not a new thing. I think that there's a higher consciousness now, and there are enough, I'd say, high profile architects or architecture firms that have really embraced that as a practice and put a capital A architecture on the idea of, you know, adaptive reuse or repositioning, from Thomas Heatherwick to Deborah Burke to you name it. You know, there's now a kind of elevation of those kinds of projects from what I, you know, think was probably unfairly perceived as, yeah, that's interesting and it has a great purpose, but it's not really, you know, you can't really make capital A architecture out of that. And I think that's no longer true.
At the onset, Studio Vera faced a distinctive challenge in redesigning a parking space that had limited flexibility in square footage due to the constraints of the existing building.
Ah, yes. I mean, this is so far classic scope creep, right? You think you just want to spit and polish, and now suddenly we're talking about taking it down to its framing.
Yeah.
And the broad design brief is to transform this big dumb box into an office. But, you know, contractor thinks it's an easy thing to do. We just want to move in, get us help get us in there. But it involved a change of occupancy, change of use. And we soon learned that going from retail to business was going to require a different parking count. Sounds pretty innocuous until you try to lay it out and realize we were nowhere close to what we needed. And they had a, you know, dedicated parking lot right in front. And we soon realized that in order to make it fit wasn't going to be, you know, to magically find some more spaces and knock out trees or whatever. It's just there wasn't a way. And it was to take a hard look at the existing square footage of this building and try to reduce that instead. So kind of back into the amount of parking that we had in our lot. And that's when we started to think that courtyards and bringing light in were going to work together to really shape the part two of this design.
Yeah, I'm sure you've heard this before, but like to say that form follows parking, unfortunately. And, you know, usually that means that you're, you know, in a new project, you're whatever, laying out parking on surface parking or a parking garage. And, you know, your building has to kind of work its way around that. In this case, as Jackie said, the parking was fixed and the building was already there. And the only way to square the circle here was to extract some square footage from the building somehow. And of course, they didn't want to lose square footage. You know, we didn't want to just lop a part of the building off.
And that wasn't really in the budget either, any more than, you know, stripping the entire, you know, facade.
Right. So we kind of had an aha moment and said, look, if we carve out a courtyard, or a couple of courtyards in the center of the building, this big 125 by 125 foot, you know, footprint that was art, you know, even with new windows, was going to be hard to daylight adequately. And we thought, okay, we can reduce the square footage. We can create these glassy courtyards in the center that bring more daylight in and actually create some accessible outdoor space for people to, you know, that work in the building to be able to enjoy, because, you know, that the outdoor space around the building was more kind of ornamental and a buffer to the highway. It's not really pleasant space to occupy. So it was sort of an interesting win-win-win that really drove the entire, you know, partie of and design of the project.
While navigating the challenges posed by site and parking constraints, Chris and Jackie highlighted a pivotal theme that would resonate throughout the entire project, codependency.
I think what we're referring to there of codependency is that the parking in the area were, you know, inherently now tied together with, you know, light and air and the quality of the space.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which doesn't always happen. And you would expect one to be its own thing and, you know, the other to really drive the design more often, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we would never, independent of the parking thing, if we'd been able to figure out how to get more cars on this lot, we would never have been able to convince the client to remove square footage from the building.
Yeah.
And you know, we could have said, oh, it's going to be dark. You're going to want more daylight and these outdoor spaces. And they would have been like, yeah, that's nice. But, you know, we're going to have as much leasable square footage as we can, you know, cause they're smart business people. Right. But that's where the unexpected codependencies become a kind of agent for architecture. And that I think is, you know, that can become the architect's superpower, really. Like when we are able to find something that we really believe in and that, you know, we're committed to, in design and find a way or discover a way that it's linked to something that you just can't argue with, you know, code or, you know, durability or budget, and kind of do the judo move and turn that on its head so that it becomes this win-win. I think that's the magic of architecture.
Right. And that's the way to defend the design, is right. To write it into the DNA.
Yeah.
You can't pull it apart anymore.
Responding to the client's wish for anonymity, the exterior presents a modest face to the nearby highway. A subtle covering of weathering corrugated steel, elevated from the dark stucco base, exudes quiet confidence and autonomy.
We did research on, you know, what the language of the context was. And I think, you know, we had to do some convincing of the local planning department on tying this into the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And luckily, affinity for metal panels tied in together with the amount of car dealerships that were around.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And what was the aesthetic that you mentioned earlier with that our client?
The stealth. Yeah.
I think that definitely comes in play inside and out.
Yeah.
And how we ended up with our language of metal exteriors.
Yeah. Yeah. To start
with.
Yeah. The strip of buildings, the commercial buildings, you know, most adjacent, I mean, it's a hodgepodge of styles, but there are buildings with metal on them, and they're, you know, generally a kind of brownish dark palette. So, you know, we were able to kind of hang our hat on that in terms of convincing the planning department and the neighborhood association. And then, as Jackie said, you know, further down, there's all these kind of, you know, car dealerships that have these zoomy, you know, metal exteriors and things. And so, you know, there was that as a precedent. And then, yeah, the stealth part, you know, just making a dark building that kind of tries to be background, you know, doesn't sort of shout, I'm here, but really kind of blends into the landscape. And all these led us to, and, you know, them wanting something durable, low maintenance to no maintenance, not fussy, led us to cladding it with weathering corrugated metal cladding that would, you know, darken over time and just kind of blend into the landscape.
So for the planning department, we did this series of before and after photos, before with the peach stucco box, and then the after with the cladding. There are renderings, and they are taken from as if you're whizzing down the highway, because this, you know, stretch of Redwood Highway actually was parallel to the 101. So everybody can see it, yeah, going up
but
and
only
down,
like,
the 101.
Like, yeah. Like that, right?
But it fit in.
It did. Yeah. And the one, you know, concession that they had us incorporate, because originally we were just, you know, it was just this unbroken, you know, 15-foot tall wall of corrugated weathering steel. They said, well, you know, it needs a cornice or something. So we did incorporate an abstracted cornice. The top 3 feet or so are perforated, and there's a metal trim, you know, architrave, if you will, that sort of sets that cornice off from the solid weathered steel. And I mean, super subtle, but we studied a lot of different perforation patterns to get the right amount so that you could see the difference between the solid and the perforated, but it wasn't so perforated that you could see, you know, the Tyvek waterproofing, you know, back behind it.
Deep recessed windows framed by steel shadow boxes and dark black metal panels further enhance the building's understated boldness.
So shadow box is actually a recurring detail that has evolved within our office on different scale, different types of projects. And I think relative to this conversation, what's really nice about it is that it it does its job. It frames the view, these, you know, relatively large, you know, openings, frames the view and really kind of delivers that glimpse inside, contrasting with the exterior. It is also a different material and it's a lot more refined, popping out from the weathering metal that's always going to be changing. Is this relatively matte constant? I think it was powder coated
steel.
Steel, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And but, it does, you know, it serves some functional purpose as well. These otherwise just, you know, straight unarticulated walls are interrupted by the punctures for the fenestration. So these shadow boxes, you know, provide a way to get some, you know, the water away from the window. They do provide some sun shading because they're 12 inches deep. So the, you know, the projection does provide a little bit of shading, although the windows face west and that's of limited use. And they provide some, you know, articulation. And again, in this otherwise, you know, taut skin, they provide some shadow. That's what we call them, you know, shadow boxes.
Yeah.
The office layout is designed for staff collaboration and productivity, organized into activity hotspots. Each project team's bullpen is marked by desk height, steel-clad partition walls with skylights overhead, housing workstations, and an acoustically sound war room at its core. I thought this layout was super cool.
There were quite a few amenities, which is very exciting that they're kind of thinking about wellness of the employees before things like well came around.
Yeah.
Such as, you know, gym and lounge space and, you know, being amenable to these outside spaces.
And a really nice big communal kitchen.
Exactly.
With a communal eating table.
Right. So there was that. And then as in terms of for those who were, you know, doing the work day to day, it wasn't just like, oh, this is where the desks will be and this is where the conference rooms will be. But in their terms, there was emphasis on collaboration. That's how they work. That makes sense, right? That's architects and contractors similar in that sense. And their term and understanding of conference was war room.
Right.
War room was the place where they were going to hash it all out. And these spaces needed to be basically immediately related to the places where people would sit down and might do their individual work. And that was the bullpen. So, yeah.
So if you look at the plan and the photos, you know, the main office area is organized around these, as Jackie says, these central war rooms, which have a tall partition, two kind of C-shaped partitions that you can enter from, you know, either side, about, I think, 6 feet tall or so. And the inside of those are a tackable surface. And the idea was, in the old days, and this has changed since then, but since we've gone, you know, digital, you know, a contractor would get a set of drawings from an architect and pull the whole thing apart, you know, into the various CSI divisions or subcontractors, right? And, you know, do area takeoffs and notes and things like that. And, you know, so that set became the kind of center of activity. And the idea was in the war room was where that drawing set was. And, you know, parts of it are pinned up on the wall and parts of it are on the table. And then the team that are working on that project are in the second ring of desks, which is the bullpen, that are centered around that war room.
And in theory, you know, a singular project, this couldn't actually be true, but a singular project was assigned to that area.
Right.
So all of the pinup space was about that. And everybody who worked on it and got together in that war room would then, you know, be hanging out and working together surrounding that space.
The interior impresses with a blend of raw materials and refined details. The industrial aesthetic is softened by an exposed sandblasted wood roof structure and new wood floors.
Well, I think the black and steel is a crowd pleaser,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And it goes right in line with their kind of stealth, industrial, but refined kind of aesthetic.
Yeah.
We use those on the outside of the bullpen, actually. Uh-huh. So the shorter partitions, mm-hmm. we use those.
And then it, you know, picks up in the framing of the, there are a row of glassed in enclosed offices along the west side. They're not blackened, but they're black metal,
yeah.
I think powder coated steel frames. And then, you know, the black storefront framing around the courtyards. And otherwise, I mean, it's all about the exposed wood roof structure, right? Which has its own inherent beauty and really just sandblasting that, cleaning it up, you know, painting all the sprinklers, organizing the new lights in a nice, you know, interesting way. And then the floor, which is a funny story.
Well, the floor we didn't have too much control over, wouldn't you say?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they basically, we knew we had to replace the, you know, they pulled up all the carpet and it was just plywood. And I think we had an idea that we would do a beautiful, you know, wide plank, a European oak, hand scraped wood floor, you know, like they do for their clients. And they just one day said, oh, we just got a 3 truckloads of reclaimed, you know, oak flooring of varying lengths and widths and colors. And we're just going to use that.
We're done.
We're done. They're like, okay,
classic.
Great.
Classic.
And it works. It works.
Yeah.
It works. You know, again, it fit in nicely with this kind of rough and refined contrast on the interior. And this is the, you know, this is the great thing about working for a contractor on their own office is, of course, they all have all these subcontractors and vendors who they give tons of work to. And so they got some favors, you know, they got, I mean, I wouldn't say they got everything for free, but they got, you know, heavy discounts on things. So, you know, where, yeah, for another client, you might not be able to afford, you know, beautiful black and steel, you know, partitions on the desks. They were able to, you know, get it, I think, for a pretty reasonable price from the vendor. And as Jackie said, it's, I think, the same fabricator that did the faceted front desk, which was a fun piece.
We had a lot of fun with the desk. I think that the story with the desk is that I think it was a perfect example of the unique process of working with a client who's also the contractor. And the propensity for a contractor to want to find what we think are shortcuts or what they're calling shortcuts. I'm not sure if they really are at the end of the day. But in any case, you know, what happened with that one is that we approached it from what we thought was going to be a very traditional linear standpoint. And we go in with, you know, square one, we have concept, we're inspired by these other, you know, desks that we see that are published. We, you know, start massing, thinking about like, you know, what's the form. And we ended up doing some early studies with potatoes, not because that's our thing. Honestly, it was mom stuck at home with young, you know, children on a really strict sleep schedule. And it's like, hey, I got these potatoes. I know we got to think up something for this desk. And actually, it was a really great material to work with because it was so immediate. And as soon as you make a slice, I'm thinking about how, you know, the form ought to be very quickly, you only really have a few more slices before you're done.
Right.
Because similar constraints on your potato were that you just couldn't get too complicated with it before it became too expensive or hard to build or dysfunctional. And so we did these early studies, had a bunch of potatoes, then took it into the 3D model. Then we're drafting in documentation, right? And out of the blue, contractor just raised their hand and said, we're done. Thank you. That's good. We'll take it from here. And, you know, we were busy with many other things. And it wasn't till months later of radio silence You know, we get the email with shop drawings attached. Yeah, they were a far distant cousin from what we had last worked on, and had to just keep going forward from there. We went to go, you know, visit the shop fabricator, and literally I remember standing over a really nice fabricator's shoulder with the AutoCAD file and just trying to identify a couple of points that we could revise and push and pull to kind of make something out of where we were, what we had at that time. And yeah, it ended up great.
Yeah.
I think everybody was happy.
Yeah.
But that was our new process for working on that one particular piece. Surprise!
Studio Vera personalized the workplace to suit the client's needs while maintaining flexibility features to adapt to evolving work dynamics.
I mean, I think, you know, it's back to that, the war room and the bullpens, you know, that finding that balance between kind of customizing it to a very specific idea of how they work, and but not making it so rigid. Because at the end of the day, it's really built around an idea of collaboration, right? And how space can foster collaboration, how space and architecture can facilitate different scales of association, right? From, you know, the individual hunkering down in that war room with, you know, the acoustical pinup panels around them and quiet and focused, to, you know, the team and being able to kind of collaborate. You know, interestingly, they don't face each other. They face outward, but yet they can turn and talk to their, you know, their teammate, which again gives this kind of, you know, you have a little both and, right? Like, you're facing out, you know, you can focus and be sort of private, or you can turn to your teammate, you know, and you're not always just sitting there, you know, talking to each other across the desk. And then, you know, beyond that, the scale of the entire, you know, workplace space and, you know, other teams and overhearing, oh, you know, they just had that same issue, you know, in project B over there. I just heard their project manager talking about it. I'm going to jump up and go talk to them over there. And that's all, I mean, that's universal to, I think, the way any business really in the 21st century works. Collaboratively, sharing of ideas, spontaneous crosstalk. And so I think that's the flexibility that we're talking about, that the design is specific, but also taps into some universals that, I mean, we could move in there tomorrow and function perfectly in that space. A tech incubator could move in there tomorrow and function in this, although there may be too much light for all the people who have to walk out, work on computers, but they can go down in the basement. I don't know.
And also the forward thinking of all the amenity spaces.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's, yeah.
That has legs over time.
That has legs, you know, that, and not that we, you know, saw the pandemic coming or, you know, are, you know, at the cutting edge of workplace trends, but, you know, understanding that, that work and life and, you know, like there aren't these kind of black and whites, right? And that, yes, people come to work, but they also, I mean, that's where they spend the majority of their daylight hours, and it needs to be a great place to be. And, you know, you form friendships at work, and you want a place that fosters that kind of casual interaction. And that incorporation into the DNA of a space, I think, also gives it the longevity and the flexibility to, you know, have a long life as a workplace for any kind of, you know, operation.
That's right.
Not all project challenges are tangible. In Chris and Jackie's case, navigating an evolving line of communication was the most significant obstacle.
Just the process, working with a contractor client.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd have to agree. I mean, it was a big learning curve for us. We hadn't worked that way and that kind of being fluid. And you know, we kept trying to rank, you know, to kind of shove that project into our process. And, you know, we have a pretty refined and rational and, you know, it's not rigid, but, you know, it's a process that allows us to work efficiently and to make decisions and not go backwards and, you know, stay on budget and on schedule and on fee and, you know, all of those things. And we kept kind of, you know, we would go down that road a little ways and realize something that we're detailing, they've already built. Like, okay, well, better not waste any time on that. And then, you know, we'd say, okay, you know, and then we would work on something else and find ourselves on that road again and detailing something that they've decided, well, we're not going to do that. Don't waste your time on it. Well, we already did. Well, don't bill us for it. Okay. And so it took us a little while to just kind of get comfortable with that and to let go.
To let go
and be like, you know, I walk in there and, you know, some of the detailing and the execution, you know, I kind of have to squint my eyes and say, it looks good enough. And to be okay with that and just kind of just let go and say, within the context of the overall goals of the project, it's all fine. It all works. And we're, you know, we're still very, very proud of it. And, you know, they are too. So that was the biggest design challenge, you know, more than anything physical.
The construction phase presented a challenge with the exterior facades and the absence of structure in the roof.
I mean, the biggest aha was really about the exterior walls and facades and the lack of structure there.
Yeah. There was some funky stuff with the roof. The roof structure, again, I said, is these big glue lambs. They have a camber on them. And, you know, that camber also kind of creates the way that the roof drains, you know, to the perimeter. And these courtyards that we carved in, you know, have parapets, you know, around the perimeter of the courtyard itself. Originally, we were going to create a sloped skylight over the top of those courtyards using cowl wall. And we were going to basically make the southern parapet taller and then, you know, slope basically so that the cowl wall was facing north to get north light. And we went around and around with the structural engineer and contractor on how to frame that wall and brace it. And the roof was also, we covered it with photovoltaics. So there was all this extra load on this roof that was never, you know, designed to have that kind of load. And at the end of the day, we had to abandon the slope skylight and parapet because we just couldn't find a cost-effective way to build that and not overload the structure. Funny enough, years later, I drive on that road, and every time I drive, I look over and look at the building because it's continued to darken, you know, over the years. Now it's just like, I mean, if you look at it today versus the photos, because we got it photographed a few months after it was finished and the weathering steel, you know, there were still some gray areas. And now it's almost like this maroon, dark building. Anyway, so I look over my shoulder one time and I see there are these big sloped skylights on top of the courtyards that they retrofitted somehow. Maybe they didn't call the engineer this time. They just built them and said, you know, screw it, we're going to build them. Because they keep the rain out and you can actually use the courtyards. They're much more functional that way.
Chris and Jackie's most significant lesson from this project revolved around the dynamic nature of collaborating with the general contractor as the client for their own building and the unique processes that entailed.
I mean, even in projects where later projects came after that, that were with that contractor and they were not the client, but it was in a different way, a very non-traditional client architect contractor, you know, relationship and delivery process. We were more, and Jackie worked on at least one of those. We were more prepared to be able to step into that stream and not, you know, try to be the rock that just resists, but kind of swim with the current.
Yeah, focus your energies.
Yeah.
Where they're really going to be used. Not matter, but used.
Right. Right.
The Redwood Highway offices showcase the successful union of architectural vision and client needs, seamlessly turning an ordinary structure into a collaborative and inviting space where industrial aesthetics meet refined functionality. Before we close out this episode, I always try to gain some additional insight from our guests about the greater industry. I was curious what advice Chris and Jackie would offer to an architect who similarly might have a general contractor as an owner and client.
I think we referred to it just now about the advantage of having candid conversations early about how we all think it's going to go down.
Yeah. You know, really, as an architect, embracing it as an opportunity to work a little differently, challenging ourselves, even if we don't plan to do it that way ever again, it's a good stretch. It forces us, you know, both to learn how to flex and get out of our comfort zone, and it reinforces why we do it the way we do it normally when that's the right way. So I think for any architect, I would say embrace it. Look at it as an opportunity. Don't be afraid. You may just do it once and never again, or you may do it and say, huh, that was interesting. Maybe I could be a little bit more flexible. And then, yeah, I think not trying to force it into a box and just having the candid conversation, you know, and saying, hey, what level of design and documentation do you want and need? And how can we provide that to you and also protect ourselves? And let's find the right balance so that we're satisfied and happy and you're satisfied and happy. And then doing that, not just at the beginning, but along the way, because it probably will change as you go along. So checking in at regular points and saying, yeah, how are we doing? You know, is this, have we got a good system here, or do we need to kind of pivot a little bit?
I really enjoyed this conversation with Chris and Jackie. I hope this episode sparks a new idea, helps you solve a problem that you've been working through, or inspires the mark that you want to leave on this world.
One thing I would like to keep in mind, remind other people, is that, you know, when you're faced with a problem, to don't forget, look to the people right in front of you. And collaboration sounds cheesy, but it's really key. I don't think anyone is expected to solve problems as an island alone in their room and then come out and be like, got it, ready? Like, you know? And so I think, yeah, the power is really in all of us together. So community, collaboration, yeah.
Actually, my personal and professional goal is to prove or demonstrate to the world that you can do great architecture, build a great firm, work on amazing projects with amazing people, and not be an asshole. I believe that in the sense of, as Jackie's saying, you know, collaboration and working with great teams and working with amazing clients, working with great contractors. Like, when we talk about the team, we talk about all of that. And our, you know, our criteria is we work with nice people, and we're nice people too. And we want to share the joy of what we do with the people that we collaborate with. And that is the most satisfying thing that we can think of.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and want to learn more, visit rcat.com/podcast to see photos, details, and more related project and product information that we discussed today. While you're there, take a look around rcat.com. For over 30 years, RCAT has been the resource for AEC professionals to find the right products for their project. Try RCAT and see how their tools can save you time and money and help you get ahead on your next project. Visit rcat.com. That's ARCAT.com. If you enjoyed the show, you can support us by subscribing, leaving a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts, and sharing this with your friends. Thanks again for listening. We'll be back to share more stories and lessons learned to help you navigate your next project.